Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
Heavy gunfire being exchanged between Mexican police and members of the Sinaloa cartel in the Mexican city of Culiacan yesterday. That after news broke out among cartel members that the son of El Chapo had been captured. The firefight yesterday, an extraordinary event. If you have a chance to see the video, it is so cinematically disturbing. It's a truly remarkable gunfight on the street. Burning vehicles were used to block roads. There were heavy weapons, including machine guns mounted in the beds of pickup trucks that took to the street. Mexican Security Secretary Alfonso Durazo said 30 members of the National Guard and Army were patrolling in Culiacan when they were fired on from a house. They repelled the attack and inside the house found Ovidio Guzman Lopez. And from there, all hell broke loose. With us to talk about what took place on the streets of Culiacan yesterday, as well as what is the latest status of the Sinaloa cartel, is NPR Mexico City-based international correspondent Kerry Khan. Kerry, thank you so much for joining us. Please elaborate on the timeline of yesterday's extraordinary events.
I'll do my best because it seems to be changing a bit from what we heard late last night from Alfonso Durazo, who you just quoted, the Mexican's head of Mexico's public security. Late last night, in a statement that was broadcast on TV and on social media, he said that, as you just described, 30 military officers were on a routine patrol and just happened to come under fire from gunmen holed up in a house. And the military was able to take control of the house, and to their surprise, inside they found the 28-year-old son of Chapo Guzman. And then shortly after that, the officers were overwhelmed by cartel gunmen, and in his words, decided to suspend the operation, that in that they had captured Ovidio Guzman Lopez, and then they let him go when they were overwhelmed and outgunned by cartel gunmen. Today, what we've heard is that they had an arrest warrant for him, and they had launched an operation to go find him. It wasn't just by happenstance that they just were fired upon by these gunmen and found him. They actually had an arrest warrant with an extradition request from the U.S. that he would be sent to the U.S. to face cocaine trafficking charges, where he's under indictment in Washington. But so what it appears is that it was an operation that just went horribly, horribly wrong. They were understaffed, undersourced. They didn't have air backup. They didn't have much backup at all. And they were overtaken by the cartel gunmen, who then unleashed what you were describing, this incredible force, display of force throughout the city. You got to know that Culiacan, Sinaloa, is the capital of the city, and it's about 1 million people, and it was just under siege for hours by these gunmen. Those bullets that we're hearing flying aren't necessarily in a gunfight with federal forces. They were just firing on the citizenry, terrorizing these people for hours in the capital of Sinaloa.
It's absolutely extraordinary. It's, to your knowledge, is
there's
this,
so much to the story that's extraordinary.
Yeah,
the fact that they captured him and then let him go is really extraordinary.
And during with all this going on in the city, is it essentially shut down today, or are residents just trying to, you know, stay in their homes to be safe?
I think the situation is still tense. Schools are closed. The airport is open, but government offices are closed. We heard the banks were open and people are trying to get on with their lives. But, you know, they have cleanup of these burned cars. People are terrorized and afraid. But there is a reinforcement now coming in of federal forces. So we'll have to see how the day proceeds.
And, you know, prior to this incident yesterday, was there a lot of violence at the street level in Culiacan related to the cartel?
It had been pretty quiet. There had been, we haven't seen violence like this in years in Sinaloa, but there had been fighting and talk about fighting amongst the group. But the interesting thing is, since the capture of Chapo Guzman and his extradition to the United States, and there had been some rumblings of a power struggle within the Sinaloa cartel, which was one of the most powerful in the country, and they'd always talk about it losing its strength and these power struggles. Well, what we saw yesterday was a very powerful cartel that was able to bring the government to its knees. The state caved. This is the message that we're hearing today, is that the state caved to the cartel members and had to release a high profile capture that they already had at their hands. They just released him. The president this morning is defending the actions and saying that it wasn't his decision. It was the decision of his security heads, but he backed them 100% because he did not want to see a massacre. The lives of hundreds of people are not worth the life of one criminal, he said. So they made the right decision, but that decision is going to be ripped apart, criticized, and really looked at closely about what the president is doing in his strategy to crack down on the cartels.
We're talking with NPR Mexico City-based international correspondent Kerry Khan about yesterday's shootout on the streets of Culiacan in Sinaloa, Mexico. Also with us is Malcolm Beith, author of The Last Narco, Inside the Hunt for El Chapo, the World's Most Wanted Drug Lord. Malcolm, thank you very much for being with us. What can you tell us about this one of many sons, as we understand, of El Chapo, Ovidio Guzman Lopez?
Sure. Thanks for having me. Ovidio was named to, he was basically indicted and named on the Treasury sanctions list it was right after Chapo Guzman's trial ended earlier this year. He is one of many sons. It's disputed right now how many there are. It's anywhere between 5 or 6 and 15. He is a key one in the eyes of the U.S., and, you know, they're all targets at this point, both from rival cartels and from the U.S. government and Mexican authorities. Well, we know that since 2016, at least, and even before Chapo was captured, brought to the United States, in, you know, under extradition, that they were struggling to hold on to the cartel. They are, you know, their successors by name, and by family, but there are lots of other forces vying for power, and that has caused violence over the last couple of years. As we all know now, it's sort of common knowledge for anyone who covers the drug wars that a splintering of the cartel or a major arrest will cause violence. It's inevitable.
When is the last time we saw something as dramatic as what happened yesterday in Culiacan?
I haven't seen anything. I covered the drug war on the ground between 2007 and 2011, and it has admittedly in some parts gotten worse in terms of full-on conflicts. But I've never seen anything quite so brazen as you know, the military being told to stand down or deciding to stand down and let him go. There have been beheadings of soldiers as repercussion. When Arturo Beltran Leyva was killed in 2009, one of the Marines who had taken part in that operation was killed himself. He was beheaded, and I think his family members were too. There's been retaliation, but not really a sort of head-on conflict where they've literally backed out of it. That I've seen, that I can remember for a long time.
Were you surprised at all how quickly the cartel members mobilized and took to the streets with the heavy weapons, given that leadership may be somewhat decentralized now?
No, not at all, actually, because I think what's happened now is, at first I thought, well, why didn't Chapo himself come into these clashes with the military? Well, I think that's because actually Chapo was just more, he had better planning sense. So he knew to use tunnels. He knew everywhere he was going so that he didn't have to travel with an entourage. Whereas the sons, they were kidnapped in 2016 by rivals. and let go under the orders of one of their one of Chapo's old cronies. And they're going to be traveling everywhere they travel now is with heavy backup, heavy, you're going to have these people in trucks with 50 caliber, machine guns on top of the trucks. And that's the only way they can travel because they're not as protected effectively, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. All right. Malcolm B., thank you for being with us. His book, The Last Narco, Inside the Hunt for El Chapo, the World's Most Wanted Drug Lord. Since that time, he was, of course, captured and convicted, serving a life sentence in a U.S. prison. And Kerry Khan, NPR international correspondent, is based in Mexico City. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, San Francisco Airport's way of getting more people to use public transit. Will it work there? Might it work here?
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
KPCC supporters include Caltech, presenting Perla Bataya in the House of Cohen. Grammy Award-nominated singer Perla Bataya takes to the stage to pay tribute to the music and life of her dear friend Leonard Cohen. The evening will celebrate the joy and brilliance of Leonard's songs through Perla's emotional and dynamic contralto. Saturday, October 19th at 8 p.m. at Caltech's Beckman Auditorium in Pasadena. Tickets available at events.caltech.edu.
I'm hearing from many of you that we have problems with our stream right now. I apologize. We are working on it to get our stream back up at kpcc.org and through the app and other sites. Our tech team, very proficient, and they're on it. So I apologize. We're working on that. In the meantime, we continue with terrestrial radio and the many transmitters that we have here from Santa Barbara to the Coachella Valley. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Film Week is coming up in just over half an hour. But first, we talk about the ongoing challenge of major metropolitan airports to get people to use public transit and to avoid taking cars or taxis or even ride-sharing vehicles to the airport to try and cut down on traffic. So at San Francisco International Airport, they're considering giving priority security line status to riders of BART, the Bay Area Rapid Transit System, which goes right to and from San Francisco International Airport. With us to talk about this idea is Media Relations Manager for BART, Jim Allison. Mr. Allison, thank you for being with us. What kind of priority status would BART riders get at SFO?
Well, Larry, it's basically a queue jump. So it's not any less screening, but it is a shorter line to get to the screening checkpoint. That's the idea.
Okay. And this is not pre-check of the TSA, correct? This is like what first class and some business class travelers get in priority?
That's right. It's not pre-check. It's priority line. So it's a different, shorter line that would presumably be an incentive for people to use public transit.
And do the airlines have to buy into this plan, or TSA, or can SFO, the airport, unilaterally do this?
Well, we're not in any kinds of discussions with the TSA. We are talking to one of the airlines as a potential partner. But yes, we're primarily talking with SFO airport staff and also the San Francisco County Transportation Authority. So those are our primary partners at this point.
And what's the status on adopting this? What needs to happen?
Well, the first step is that we need our elected board of directors to consider a change in our surveillance policy. It's kind of complicated, but basically we want to use a type of technology that will verify that people who want to get into that priority lane have actually ridden BART. So we need to first adopt a change to our surveillance policy. And so the board will be considering that on October 24th, next Thursday. So that's the very first step. Then we need to develop the technology and work with the airport. And then eventually, if everything proceeds as planned, SFO would hire staff at the security checkpoints and use a mobile device to scan a Clipper card, which is akin to the tap card in L.A.,
yeah,
or one of our applications, the QR code on an application, and just make sure that people actually did ride BART to the airport.
Now, Jim, are there estimates of how much time people could save in the priority line? I haven't ever used one of those. I always fly coach. So I was wondering what the estimates are for time savings.
Yeah, we haven't gotten to that level of detail yet. We really need to first cross the first milepost, which is whether the board actually wants to proceed with this or not.
Okay. Do you have stats on the percentage of SFO passengers who use BART versus other ways of arriving and departing the airport?
I don't have that at my fingertips, but I can tell you that basically 13,000 people a day use BART to get to the airport, which is pretty good, but it is down from our high water mark in 2013 when we started to see Uber and Lyft really erode our ridership. And we've seen that play out over the last 5-6 years to the point where we lost 10% of our ridership just in 2018 compared to the previous year.
Is that overall or to the airport ridership?
To the airport. So it's we didn't anticipate the advent of Uber and Lyft, but they're kind of eating our lunch right now. And so we're trying to be creative to find ways to bring people back to what we think is a great service. You can get on a train and ride right into the international terminal and hop on a plane. So if we can shorten the line for somebody, make the experience of getting through the boarding process a little less painful, then, we're game to try that.
All right, Jim Allison joining us from Bay Area Rapid Transit, known as BART. He's the Media Relations Manager. BART is considering giving, if San Francisco International Airport agrees with this, priority security line status to BART riders over those who use vehicles to get to the airport. The idea to build rapid transit, cut down on traffic, to see environmental gains that would come from using the BART trains instead of people taking cars, their own or a services car, to get to or from the airport. Do you anticipate that you would have to add capacity? Do you think there'd be enough demand to do that?
Right now, our airport trains have capacity to carry more people into the airport, so we're not concerned about that.
All right. I want to thank you very much, sir, for being with us. I appreciate it. Jim Allison, Media Relations Manager for BART in San Francisco in the Bay Area. What do you think of this idea? Does it rub you the wrong way that people that would ride public transit would be able to have a shorter wait in the TSA line? Or does it make sense that that is a fair incentive for people to use public transit? 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPECC. What do you think of this idea? Does it make sense to you? Is it fair to offer this? Obviously, for people who get the priority status because they buy a more expensive ticket on an airline, are going to have more people in that line at SFO. So, they might not be so thrilled with the fact that they are getting that priority TSA status. Again, different than TSA PreCheck. They might feel that there's more competition there in that line and not like it. 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Also with us from the website that covers global travel, Skift, Senior Aviation Business Editor Brian Summers. Brian, good to have you back with us on Air Talk. Before we get to LAX and whether this might be feasible, do you think an inducement like this might be enough to get more people to ride BART?
Thanks for having me back, Larry. It's good to be back on the show. I presume that you have brought me back so that I could be the voice of reason here. And I have to tell you, I fly more than 100,000 miles per year. And I can tell you almost unequivocally, absolutely not. First of all, as you pointed out a couple of times, the priority line, despite its name, is not the security line that you want to be in. You want to be in the pre-check line. That one moves faster. SFO can't let you in that line because you need to go through a background check, things like that. So you're talking about saving very little time and no effort, because you're still going to have to take off your shoes, your belt, all that stuff that people don't like to do. Second of all, look, you know, it's not 2013 anymore. We all want to take Uber and Lyft to and from the airport. We just do. It's cheap. It's frictionless. We've all gotten used to it. We're probably not going to go back to taking public transit unless they can make a very compelling incentive to us. And I just don't think that priority security, especially since in this case, priority is essentially in quotes, is going to do the trick.
Well, and so then by extension, I'm guessing you're not very optimistic that Metro extending its light rail service to LAX and the people mover that it's going to be connecting to through the transportation center, you don't think that that's going to significantly cut the number of cars going to LAX?
I'm afraid not, Larry. I mean, have people looked at the maps of where these metro lines go? I mean, if you live off the Green Line, if you live off the Crenshaw Line, and certainly people do, this is going to be convenient at LAX. But if you're flying in from New York or London or Sydney, you're not going to a lot of those neighborhoods. It's not where the hotels are. It's not where the tourist attractions are. You want to go to Santa Monica. You want to go to Beverly Hills. You want to go to Hollywood. You want to go to downtown. If you want to take public transit to those places from LAX, even after 2023, you're talking about two or three trains. You're talking about an hour or more of your life. You have to really, really want it. So I think Uber and Lyft are going to be a big part of the LAX experience for the foreseeable future.
Even with traffic, you don't think there'd be a public transit time benefit, even with a transfer?
It's hard to say. I mean, I'll tell you, I do fly up to San Francisco a lot, and I'm sure the listeners do as well. BART is about as convenient as you can get. It goes right to one of the terminals. So if you fly to United or the International Terminal at SFO, you don't have to get on a people mover. You get right on the train, and it takes you into central San Francisco. That should be a line that people really want to take, and they're saying that they have some trouble. That's a bad omen for Los Angeles, especially in a world where Lyft and Uber are so cheap, efficient, and they're fast. It's hard to see folks getting on public transit when they can get an Uber and Lyft. Like, we all know that traffic is an issue in L.A.,
right,
but it's an issue for everyone, and I think we've gotten used to it.
Well, I want to hear from listeners. What do you think? Do you agree with Brian Summers that using mass transit to the airport is essentially a lost cause with Uber and Lyft? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about a proposal in San Francisco for its extremely busy airport that riders of BART, the Bay Area Rapid Transit System, that they would be able to get priority, the priority line, priority access for TSA screening. That's not the same as what is the federally government-approved TSA pre-check program. That requires a background check. You pay to be a part of that. That's a different system. But this gives you priority status in line similar to what first-class travelers often get from their respective airlines. Do you think that if SFO ends up partnering with BART to do this, that it will significantly increase the number of rapid transit users into and out of San Francisco International. And if LAX were to adopt something similarly, once we have light rail that goes to LAX and a people mover that wraps around all the terminals, do you think that that would significantly cut down on the number of cars that go to and from LAX? 866-893-KPECC. Nicole in Boyle Heights, you just heard Brian Summers of Skift, the website covering travel, say he didn't think this is going to make a difference. What do you think?
I disagree with Mr. Summers simply for the fact that Uber and Lyft are not going to be cheap for very much longer. The venture capital money is running out. These companies are both unprofitable, and the prices are about to go up precipitously. And getting out of LAX, they're pretty high anyway. This past Monday, I tried to take a Lyft out of LAX to Boyle Heights, and they wanted to charge $75. So what I ended up doing was taking the flyaway bus to Union Station and then taking an Uber from there, which was like $20. It was cheaper overall. So I don't think that the argument that, you know, Lyft is so much more convenient is going to work. And it really isn't affordable for many people as it is anyway.
All right, Nicole, I appreciate it very much. So Brian Summers, just yesterday we were talking about this L.A. City Council proposal to mandate a $30 an hour minimum wage and expense reimbursement to Uber and Lyft drivers, which obviously would raise the cost of the fares for riders. So could that paired with a public transit incentive make a difference?
It could, but, you know, we're just as likely to go back to the old days. I think many of us remember it as recently as, 7 years ago, and we didn't have Uber and Lyft. People would go, they were more likely to pick up friends and relatives at the airport, stuff like that, or gasp. They were even driving their own cars to the airport and parking a couple miles away and taking a shuttle bus for a reasonable price. We're making good progress on public transit in Los Angeles. I live here. I love it. I take it when I can. But this is not perfect. The people at LAX know it. Metro knows it. It's just not going to be as seamless here as it is in a lot of other cities. And again, I go back to San Francisco. BART to the airport there looks really good. It works.
Yeah.
And if they're having trouble filling their trains, it's just not good for other cities.
Let me go back to Jim Allison of BART, Media Relations Manager. Want to just give us a quick response to what Brian was arguing?
Well, Larry, I would not want to argue with Brian's expertise in air travel. The one thing that we're looking at this as a very low-cost way to see if we can move the needle on ridership to the airport. We think we can develop the software in-house, and so why not try that approach? We've already got another incentive where we offer up to a 25% discount for mobile ticketing for group travel. We're trying that. So we're basically trying whatever we can to try to get back some of the ridership we have lost to these ride-sharing services. And then, as Brian mentioned, BART to the SFO airport is really convenient for a lot of travelers who come in to, say, do business in downtown San Francisco, because you can just walk from your hotel, get on BART, and walk off and get on your airplane. We, in the Bay Area, have the 101 freeway, which serves the airport, and that can be a real mess if there's just one lane that's shut down due to a fender bender. Whereas BART is on time 95% of the time.
That's a really good point about the traffic issue, which obviously you don't avoid with ride-hailing companies and that you do when you're taking BART. Let's talk with Myrna in Baldwin Hills, who has the advantage of living close to the airport already in Baldwin Hills. Myrna, thanks very much. What do you think?
Yes, I do live close, and I cannot imagine taking public transportation because I don't know how many buses I would have to take to even get to a train. And also, I'm a senior, and sometimes I need help with my luggage, so using public transportation would not work for that. And I can't imagine families with small children and the kids and all the little bags that the kids have to carry on would work. And so that's my comment.
All right. I appreciate it. Myrna in Baldwin Hills, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Justin in Palms, Would this work at Los Angeles to give an incentive priority TSA screening for public transit riders?
Hey, I don't know if that would be the best route to go. Trying to improve mass transit by that sounds like almost some sort of a security compromise. But I know that I'm just an average airport Uber riding, just an average person that doesn't go to the airport all the time. And I tried to get home for little to no money the other day because I had some time to spare, and it wasn't that bad of an experience. And I think with just a little bit of clarification on bus routes and tweaks to the in and out system for the airport, I think the mass transit to the airport could be greatly improved for just average riders, everyday airport users, and people that it's just more simple to call an Uber. But like several of the previous callers,
yeah,
it's not that cheap, and it's not going to get any.
And it's door to door. But I also think Jim Allison of BART, his point that, you know, in San Francisco, where you can go right from the hotel, go right one train to the airport or back, it is very convenient, and you don't have to deal with 101 traffic. Meredith, in Northridge, you used to live up in the Bay Area, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, and did you use BART to get to SFO?
We did. We did once, and it was a hassle because we were in the south, like we were in Mountain View, so we were south of the BART system.
Yeah.
So we had to take Caltrain to the BART, but they don't work together at all. And so transferring over from Caltrain to BART with luggage and kids just was horrible and took an extra half hour both going to and from the airport.
Okay, so by extension, you don't think it would work here too well?
No, I don't think it would work unless they fixed working with already existing public transportation systems.
Okay. Meredith, I appreciate it very much. Chris in Silver Lake, I got about 30 seconds for you. You see it opposite of that, right?
No, well, I do see it opposite. Yeah, I was just in San Francisco, and I took the BART from the airport, and I thought it was great, especially compared with our options in Los Angeles. And it was so much cheaper than Uber or Lyft. In San Francisco, I want to say it was like $50 to get to the airport. So, you know,
using Uber or Lyft. Yeah.
Yeah. Using Uber or Lyft. So the BART is a much more inexpensive option. And I think we could strive to have something like that in LA.
Chris, I appreciate your call. Thank you very much for being with us. Jim Allison is Media Relations Manager for BART, Bay Area Rapid Transit. And this proposal, as he said, there are multiple steps of approval before they can enter into an agreement with San Francisco International Airport on giving priority TSA line status to the users of BART going to SFO. And Brian Summers joins us often to talk about travel issues. He's Senior Aviation Business Editor for Skift. Brian, as always, we appreciate it very much. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We are 7 minutes away from Film Week. We'll count you down. Got some really interesting sounding movies.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle, joined this week by critics Wade Major of Cinegods.com and Christy Lemire, who's a triple threat. She writes film criticism for RogerEbert.com, co-hosts Breakfast All Day podcast, tweets at Christy Lemire, and they're going to get right into the reviews this week. We begin with Maleficent, Mistress of Evil, a sequel to Disney's 2014 film Maleficent. Angelina Jolie is back. Elle Fanning as well, reprising their roles as the evil fairy Maleficent and her granddaughter Aurora. Their relationship here strained when a prince proposes to Aurora.
Philip asked me to marry him.
Poor thing. He'll recover.
My answer was yes.
No.
Yes.
No.
I wasn't really asking.
Nor was I.
What's next? You'll turn him into a goat.
Disney's Maleficent, Mistress of Evil. The film is directed by Joachim Rønning. Christy, what'd you think?
So this is one of two sequels we have this week that I'm not really sure why they exist. There's no need for this at all.
I have some idea why.
A little bitty one. This is almost not campy enough. The clip we just played made the movie sound kind of light and kind of jokey. You have Angelina Jolie. You also have Michelle Pfeiffer as the queen, the mother of Prince Philip, whom Aurora is going to marry. Both venerable, just formidable female screen forces. And I almost wish they were allowed to be campier and vampier in meeting each other. The central conflict here is that you have Maleficent meeting Prince Philip's parents. And it's like a weird jokey version of Meet the Fockers, but with genocide. There's like a whole genocide subplot as to what is really going on here in the kingdom with the kingdom and the Moors and the fairies and the conflict over the territory. Yeah. It's a weird mix of stuff. There's a lot going on here, like a lot more than there should be. At one point, my son, who's almost 10, turned to me at the giant climax where all the battles are going on at the same time and all the subplots are tying up and they're jumping back and forth and there's red dust exploding into the sky. My son turns to me, he goes, I have absolutely no idea what's going on right now. And I'm like, I kind of do, but I don't blame you. So it's confusing. Yeah.
What do you think, Wade?
I'm less enthused. Sleeping Beauty has a very treasured place in my household. My wife loves it. My daughter loves it. So they saw the first Maleficent for the first time just the other day and were a little bit taken back by the revisionism of it. That they're trying to redeem Maleficent as a character. They take King Stefan and make him a bit of a bad guy. It really kind of upends the fairy tale, but it doesn't completely rewrite it. This is not only unnecessary, it's a betrayal of the entire lore. This takes everything that they left intact in the first film and just says, you know what, let's just throw it all out. Let's just completely rewrite Sleeping Beauty and make everything that you thought you knew about it completely false, and it'll be a whole new story. If you love Sleeping Beauty as a story and understand all of and appreciate all of the nuances to it and the messages and the themes, you're going to be furious with this because this leaves it a complete wreckage. This just trowels it over for the sake of money just to have an unnecessary sequel to invent some new subplot about tolerance that the first film really already did. And then with this horrible CGI marveled kind of finale battle that goes on forever, basically looks just like the scene in the old Flash Gordon movie where the Hawkman raid all the spaceships from Ming. It's the same scene, only done less well.
Yeah,
with
I was
going to
say, that's a pretty cool scene.
It's a cool scene in Flash Gordon. Yeah. Here it's just overwrought, and they lean on the CGI excessively, and it's just a completely unnecessary movie.
There's a spindle. That's about the only tie you have to the first.
Yeah.
I will say the costume design is extraordinary. It's exquisitely detailed what Michelle Pfeiffer gets to wear. And then all the really cool stuff that Angelina Jolie gets to wear, it reminded me of like Natalie Portman's ballet costumes, the Rodarte stuff she wore in Black Swan. Anyway, but not worth seeing for that.
All right. Maleficent, Mistress of Evil is rated PG. Angelina Jolie, Elle Fanning, Michelle Pfeiffer star. It's rated PG in wide release. Zombieland, Double Tap, the second sequel to which Christy was just referring. Woody Harrelson, Emma Stone, Jesse Eisenberg are back with Abigail Breslin. Ruben Fleischer directs, and it's written by Dave Callahan, Rhett Reese, and Paul Wernick. Wade.
Yeah, there's really no reason why I should like this, but I do. And I readily admit that what they did here that was smart that they didn't do on Maleficent, they brought the original creative team back, same director, same writers. They brought them all back, same, you know, everyone from the cast, and they kind of put them through the same paces all over again. And in a decade later, after hundreds of intervening hours of other zombie movies and zombie television, it doesn't feel fresh anymore. However, I do appreciate that the cast is still having fun. They enjoyed getting back together. Emma Stone can do no wrong. She overrides all of my neurological reaction to Jesse Eisenberg. Mm-hmm. And Zoe Deutsch, one of a handful of people who has kind of a semi-cameo in it. She has an interesting recurring character as this stereotypical dumb blonde that she adds somehow more dimension to. She makes her dumber and blonder than anyone's ever seen. I thought her banter with Emma Stone was a lot of fun. So it kept me going on a character level, even if nothing else about it was worthwhile.
Christy?
This is simultaneously more and less. Like, more characters, more action, more plot.
More shtick.
But it's like, right, and it's a lot of the same kind of meta fourth wall breaking. It's a zombie movie that knows it's a zombie movie. There is wall-to-wall Jesse Eisenberg narration explaining everything to us, explaining things that should be obvious, but also explaining things that we are seeing with our own two eyes on the screen, but not in a way that's like amusing or insightful at all. Zoe Deutsch is adorable, I agree. And they put her in these like pink Juicy Couture sweats and a Von Dutch tank top because she is like a 2009 time capsule unto herself. Yeah, they're all just doing the same thing all over again. And I just wonder why. Like, it's a whole lot of wheel spinning. There is a thing you should stick around for in the credits, though.
Oh, yeah, for sure. All the way to the end.
Zombieland Double Tap from Ruben Fleischer, the director. It's rated R in wide release. The hallucinatory tale with just two characters, The Lighthouse, stars Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe. Robert Eggers is the director and co-screenwriter with his brother Max Eggers. Christy.
I love this movie so much. One of my absolute favorites this year, and I was really looking forward to it. From the first time I saw the trailer, it made my heart like jump out of my chest because it looked so beautiful and so weird, and it's everything I wanted it to be, so I'm really excited about it. So Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe play lighthouse keepers. And they are stuck together on this mysterious remote island off the coast of New England. It's the late 1800s. And it's just the two of them. And they're really different people. And the longer they stay, the longer they're stuck there, they lose their grasp on their sanity. And you begin to wonder whether you are still sane while you're watching it, because you don't know what's a hallucination, what's real, what's what they've imagined, what's just, you know, what's actually happening in this bizarre out there place. It is shot in exquisitely gorgeous black and white. It's so beautiful. And you can tell it was a very physical and emotionally demanding performance for them both. These are actors who take chances, and they are taking chances together, and it is thrilling to watch.
I didn't get a chance to ask you, Brent. I thought I might have read several weeks ago that the aspect ratio was different. Is it?
Yeah, it's an Academy aspect
ratio. It's not
ratio.
Academy. Okay.
It's an old.
It's 119.
119. It's not even Academy.
It's not. It's real close. It's almost a total box.
Okay.
Well, that's interesting.
It looks like it, though.
I was trying to count while I was using an optical counting. I thought it was Academy. Wow, amazing.
But that adds to the feeling of like it being old and like a little time capsule.
Wow. Well, I admire it. I don't particularly love it. I think it's very much the same thing that Eggers and his brother were doing with The Witch, which is taking a very constrained period horror concept and doing kind of a resume piece with it. The sound design is amazing. The photography is amazing. The art direction is amazing. Technically, it is an extraordinary achievement, but it's still kind of a little mini Twilight Zone experiment. It's still kind of a conceit. And that has me a little bit worried that perhaps they don't want to exit this very small and contained world where they have complete control, that they want to keep making kind of quasi-Polanski movies. It's basically Repulsion with two guys in a lighthouse instead of Catherine Deneuve in her apartment. But there's something in it. Perhaps that's the world we live in now, where if you're an auteur and you want complete control, you have to live in this world. You don't get bigger budgets.
All right.
Maybe he wants to live in that world.
He may.
He's really good at that world.
He is.
So it is shot in 119, one that was apparently used by Fox, particularly at the early sound era.
Ooh.
And so that's what, that's apparently, that's the New York Times, Ben Kenigsberg says, he explains that about the film. So we appreciate that. Again, the film is The Lighthouse. Robert Pattinson, Willem Dafoe star, Robert Eggers direct and co-wrote with Max Eggers. It's rated R, and you can see it at the Arclight Hollywood and the Landmark in West Los Angeles. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. Many more movies to come, including Jojo Rabbit and Parasite. Good to have you with us on Film Week here on 89.3 KPECC. Back with more with Christy and Wade momentarily.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. So good to have you with us, Larry Mantle, with our critics Christy Lemire and Wade Major. Next up is Jojo Rabbit, a comedic drama from writer-director Taika Waititi. Roman Griffin Davis stars as a boy living in World War II Germany whose imaginary friend is Adolf Hitler.
Poor Jojo. What's wrong, little man?
Hi, Adolf.
Want to tell me about that rabbit incident? What was all that about?
They wanted me to kill it. I'm sorry. I couldn't.
Don't worry about it. I couldn't care less.
But now they call me a scared rabbit.
Let them say whatever they want. People used to say a lot of nasty things about me. Oh, this guy's a lunatic. Oh, look at that psycho. He's going to get us all killed.
That's the voice of Waititi in as the rabbit, is that right?
No, he's Hitler.
Hitler.
Or Hitler, okay,
yes.
All right. Jojo Rabbit is the film we're talking about. So Waititi in the cast as well. Roman Griffin Davis stars. Wade, please start us.
I kind of feel like a proud papa. It was 2004 when I was on the AFI Shorts jury with Ray McKinnon and Shohreh Aghdashloo, and we chose as best short that year a little short called Two Cars, One Night by a young filmmaker named Taika Waititi. Went on to get an Oscar nomination. Here he is. So I'd like to believe that we played some small role in getting him here, because this is one of my favorite films of the year. It's an amazing film. It returns him to the sensibilities of the Hunt for the Wilder People, as opposed to Thor Ragnarok, which is sort of him doing his studio thing. But these are his sensibilities, a quirky way of looking at the world, but with kind of a razor edge of observation underneath it. The way that Searchlight is promoting this is it's kind of like a World War II version of a Wes Anderson movie. And it has a little bit of that at the beginning, but it goes from the absurd to the poignant in a very, very acute way. And that's what's so smart about the film, because it's a sleight of hand. It doesn't let you know where it's going, and it takes you in a direction that's completely unexpected and totally rewarding. And it's so unique, and it's so unusual, and it's just such a refreshing breath of incredibly fresh air. I can't think of a better film this week.
Christy.
I'm amazed this movie exists. And I know that Taika Waititi tried to make it for like a decade. And then finally, it just had to be that he had to be the one to play Hitler. And it's hilarious. Like, it's such a fine line that this film walks. And he pulls off these incredible tonal swings. Mm-hmm. Like, they're acrobatic. And I don't know how he did it, because in the beginning, off the top, you are laughing hysterically over and over and over again at this goofy 10-year-old boy's image of like Hitler as his imaginary best friend. And he seems like a little kid. And so the idea of like depicting Hitler in that way is just so daring and could have gone so wrong. By the end, for the last 20 minutes, I was sobbing off and on for the last 20 minutes. And so to go from one extreme to the other,
that's
is incredible.
That's the genius of it. But that's the way he looks at the world. Right. That's how he sees the world.
There's such truth to it. The little boy who stars in it, Roman Griffin Davis, is tremendous because he has to hold the whole thing together, right? Mm-hmm. Opposite all these really established stars. Sam Rockwell has a good time playing a goofy Nazi leader. Scarlett Johansson is completely lovely as the mom trying to hold it all together. Again, tremendous costume and production design here. I love this movie.
Did they film it in Waititi's New Zealand or in Europe?
Oh, that's a good question.
It's somewhere in Europe. It's a town that was still intact after World War II that still looked like that.
Okay.
And I have to say, too,
Czech Republic. Okay.
My mother grew up in Hitler's Germany. She was 10 years old when they were all pushed into the Hitler Youth and went through all that stuff. And everything she told me is reflected in those early scenes in this movie, which was it was the dumbest thing we had ever done. It was ridiculous. And the absurdism of it that lingered with her even in old age, what an outrageous, just an absurd practice, that has never been communicated in any other movie. Taika gets it here. It's a farce. The whole thing is a farce. And even though it's tied to one of the great tragedies of history, you can process those two things at the same time. And well, it's an amazing, like Christy says, it's an amazing balancing act.
Is tonally, does it bear any resemblance to Chaplin's The Great Dictator?
In some way, I would say a little bit. Chaplin walks a similar fine line,
yeah.
But Chaplin doesn't go to the same emotional place Taika does here. So in terms of depicting Hitler as a clown, and that there's certainly that aspect to it, there I think it has a similarity. But even Chaplin didn't think that he could cross the line the way that Taika does here.
And even comparing it to like Mel Brooks comes a little close,
but still not there.
But this has a far deeper emotional poignancy to it than any Mel Brooks film does.
True.
We're talking about Jojo Rabbit, new film from director, writer Taika Waititi, Roman Griffin Davis, Scarlett Johansson, Waititi himself star in the film. It's rated PG-13 and it's at selected theaters. Parasite was released last week, the South Korean film that has been a critic's favorite at the many film festivals that it's been playing. We wanted to give a chance for you to hear our critics talk about it. Wade, Parasite.
Absolutely extraordinary achievement on every conceivable level, even though I think it's still a little bit of a cheat. He's one of our great, I mean, from The Host to Snowpiercer to Okja, I mean, he is one of our great global filmmakers. Bong Joon-ho has an unbelievable command of visuals, of pace, of all of the technical aspects of storytelling. He gets out of his actors unbelievable performances. It's an amazing, it deals with class, as in many other stories, and it is that he tells, where you have this impoverished family of grifters who ingratiate themselves into the servant conditions of a wealthy family and all of the very bizarre things that transpire thereafter. But it still plays with a lot of these contrivances that are very obvious. He makes things happen so that he can do something that he wants to do. And so even though I admire it, I still see him...
You felt a little manipulated.
I see him pulling the levers.
This is the best movie of the year at this point in time. I've got a couple out there that I still have to see that might unseat it. But again, kind of like Jojo Rabbit, this is a tonal marvel because it begins as this really dark, sharp satire of economic disparity, of haves and have-nots. You do have these two families that are mirroring each other, mother, father, sister, brother. And it slowly but surely becomes like almost a straight-up horror film. And then the ending is just heartbreaking. And so to go through all these extremes is exquisitely photographed and perfectly paced. And the stuff that Wade thinks is manipulative, I thought was really cool, the way he would like set up certain pieces, certain dominoes to then fall down later on. I thought I appreciated the meticulous nature of that storytelling.
I did too. It just took me away from the characters. I was paying more attention to the directing than I was to the character interactions. And I wanted to fall more in with the characters. But it is still, look, it is an amazing achievement. All of my reservations notwithstanding, there is not a better film all year in terms of a guy who knows what to do with the camera.
Writer-director Bong Joon-ho of South Korea. The film is Parasite, rated R, in select theaters. The animated The Addams Family by Conrad Vernon and Greg Tiernan was out last week as well, still in theaters. Christy?
It's cute. It's okay. It's got this embarrassment of riches in terms of its voice cast. You have Oscar Isaac and Charlize Theron and Chloe Grace Moretz and Finn Wolfhard and Nick Kroll. It's the Addams Family in animated form. It's very family friendly. The message here is extremely trite and pat. It's about people trying to fit in and all be like each other, but it's really important to just be yourself. And so the Addams Family lives on top of their hill and they're trying to fit in with the suburbia down at the bottom of the hill, but it's also really important to still be the weirdo that you are inside. And there's not much to it. It's, if your kids want to see it, it's fine.
The Addams Family, the new animated version, is rated PG. It's in wide release. Also out in wide release last week, Will Smith, starring in Ang Lee's Gemini Man. Christy?
So I so appreciate that at this point in his career, Ang Lee is still messing with technology. He's still pushing it. I appreciate the instinct behind that. I appreciate the ambition behind that. Gemini Man, like Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk a few years back, is shot in the higher frame rate, 120 frames per second, as opposed to the 24 we are accustomed to. That means the images are really incredibly sharp and bright, like more so than even you would see with the human eye, in a way that is so distracting. and like it's like an assault on your eyeballs, actually. And maybe you get used to it, but like you shouldn't. So Will Smith runs into a younger version of himself. And I guess there's a great allegory in that, as Will Smith is now middle-aged, I suppose, like we all are. And it's fine. Some of the action is fun. But again, it's really hard to get past the look of it.
I don't think you're technically middle-aged yet.
But I have 47. Yeah, 47 is middle-aged.
Yeah, not quite. Gemini Man, the film, Will Smith, Mary Elizabeth Winstead. Ang Lee is the director, and David Benioff, Billy Ray, and Darren Lemke are the screenwriters. It's rated PG-13. Wait, do you have an opinion on that high frame rate? I don't like the look of it myself.
I hate it. And it's a funny thing, too, because, you know, with the new iPhones, when you shoot video of your family, you can choose to use a higher frame rate there as well. And I find I don't even like higher frame rate video of my own child. I like it a little softer. It's what Christy says. There is something assaultive about the hyper reality of it. Yeah.
Like the lighting is too flat and too hot and too bright. It looks fake.
It's almost like that soap opera effect you sometimes get with newer televisions that do the sort of auto correction of the image.
Motion
smoothing. And it doesn't look real, even though you are getting many more frames per second. We're talking about the shooting technique on Gemini Man, which is rated PG-13 in wide release. Coming up, we'll hear what Wade and Christy think about The Cave, which is a documentary from Syria, Tell Me Who I Am, a British documentary, and Cyrano, My Love, a historical comedy from Belgium and France. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. We're so pleased to have you with you every week right here on 89.3. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. Christy Lemire, Wade Major, our critics this week. And next is the documentary from Syria, The Cave, which tells the story of the Syrian doctor, Dr. Amani Balour. Christy?
This film is just stunning, and it is a miracle that it got made, and it's a miracle that it got out to the world for us to see it, but I'm so glad that it is. So director Firas Fayyad, whose film Last Men in Aleppo from a couple of years back was an Academy Award nominee.
Terrific film.
He returns to his home of Syria to tell the story of this whole underground system of tunnels and caves, and in the middle of them is this hospital, which is run by women doctors. And the main one that he follows is Dr. Amani, who you mentioned. And it's about how they just deal day in and day out with being just attacked and bombed and the carnage that they witness and just trying to survive, trying to keep people alive. Each new day is worse than the last. And Firas Fayyad, to his credit, I don't know how he does it, but he has the presence of mind and the focus to keep shooting, to not turn away. It's unflinching in its depiction of the horrors that exist there. And it's unfortunately now even timelier than ever, but it's a fascinating study of the strength of women when they are allowed to display that strength in a situation like this. Women in a place of leadership, which is unusual.
She's running this underground hospital.
She is, with several other female doctors as well. And so that in itself is remarkable, but like you see everything. You see how she's warm and how she's strict when she needs to be. You see her eventually collapse, and how would you not? It's stunning.
It is.
The Cave is the film.
It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. It's shot over a number period of several years in eastern Syria, where some pretty horrible stuff has happened. We can't obviously give you all of the historical details about this because it'll give too much away in the film. But there's a portion of the film, about a half hour segment later on, which is almost purely visual. And if you don't completely crumple down and cry, you don't have a heart. It's a devastating film.
The Cave, the documentary from Firas Fayad, Oscar-winning documentarian. It's unrated at Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles. The documentary Tell Me Who I Am follows 18-year-old identical twin Marcus, who must help his twin Alex remember his life after Alex suffers a traumatic motorcycle accident. Ed Perkins, the director. Christy?
This is also an incredible documentary, and it is about, as you say, these two brothers, identical twins, living in a very wealthy home in England. This really serious motorcycle accident occurs, which wipes out pretty much all of the memory of one of the brothers. The only thing he does remember is that he has an identical twin. And that twin then helps him reconstruct what their life was like. Here are your parents. Here's where we live. Here's where we went on vacation. But what he did was reconstruct a totally fabricated life to protect his brother from the truth of the horrors of their childhood. And the way this film is constructed is this suspenseful mystery, and eventually it gives way to great catharsis and redemption. But you hear one brother's story and then the other brother's story, and then the two sit down opposite each other to finally share the truth of what happened, and it's heartbreaking.
It's amazing. I mean, it was originally a book in the UK, but the book only went to a certain point. The filmmakers complete the story in a rather extraordinary way and a very bold way. Ed Perkins is his feature directing debut, but he is a very experienced and seasoned filmmaker on British television, and it shows. This is a very accomplished film in the Errol Morris style, where recreation is used to sort of complement what you see in the interviews and the archival materials that they're able to put together. But he doesn't do it the way that others typically have. If you look at something like Man on Wire, which is all recreation, or Thin Blue Line, which is substantially, this pulls back more than those. It doesn't try to influence what your perception of what they're saying, and it's really beautiful filmmaking.
Tell Me Who I Am is at Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica, and it's streaming on Netflix. The film is unrated. The historical comedy Cyrano, My Love, is written and directed by Alexis Michalik. What'd you think, Wade?
I love this movie. This is one of my favorite films of the year as well. This is basically a French Shakespeare in Love. This is Alexis Michalik, who wrote and directed it, is a veteran French actor, has never made a feature before, never wrote a feature before, but he did write a very successful play that this is based on called Edmond, which is the story of how Edmond Rostand eventually succeeded, overcame years of failure and being supported by his wife with, you know, children that he could barely feed, and how he became the toast of Europe with the greatest production in history in French theater, Cyrano de Bergerac. It's that story. And it had a great success with the play. Here he blows it up big into a movie, which is just great French filmmaking. It's a period piece. It's got costumes. It's funny. It's romantic. It has twists and turns. Wonderful cameos from other legendary figures of the era. All of it takes place in 1895 to 1897, and it is just an absolute joy to watch.
We're talking about Cyrano, My Love, the French film at Lemley's Royal in West Los Angeles. The film is rated R. Christy, can you give us just a few seconds on Greener Grass, the comedy?
I would love to, because this movie is nuts and I totally dug it. It's this really focused, really exaggerated, extreme satire of suburbia. It is candy colored. It is weird. It is out there. I laughed the whole way through.
It's right. Ira Levin on LSD.
So opposite opinions of Greener Grass. The comedy is at the Landmark in West L.A. Jocelyn DeBoer and Don Luby are the stars, as well as the writer-directors of the unrated film. Well, earlier this week, we lost Robert Forster, the great character actor who passed away of brain cancer at the age of 78. He's one of my favorites. Great role in Jackie Brown, the Quentin Tarantino film. And Tarantino really brought Forster back to public attention. And I interviewed Forster prior to our film week screening of Jackie Brown. This goes back to 2017. And here Forster talks about running into Quentin Tarantino in a West Hollywood cafe, starting the conversation that led to Tarantino's casting Forster as bail bondsman Max Cherry. Forster was struggling. His career was at a low ebb. And I asked him how far down it was at the time and how he managed to move back up.
Oh, I was catching crumbs that fell through the cracks. I was in the basement by then. I had four children and two ex-wives and was trying to hold it together. And you know, there are moments at which you say to yourself, do I have to find something new to do, or do I get a chance to continue this? Am I going to have to quit being an actor? And I had an epiphany walking into the tennis park over on Fountain Avenue. I said to myself, I watched Joe Stein over there gently hitting the ball against the wall. Joe Stein was 79 years old. He was a psychiatrist. He still had patience. He was still writing books, and he could beat me at tennis. All I had to do was get the ball to him, and he could put it anywhere on the court he wanted to. I would chase around. I said, that's the answer. Don't quit, Bob. If you quit, you got to think of something else to get good at and make a living at. If you don't quit, you still got a shot. Joe Stein is never quits. You can win it in the late innings if you don't quit. And then I said, yeah, but how are you going to get from the hole you're in to winning it in the late innings? And I said, you deliver your excellent best right now. That will give you the best shot at the best future you got coming, and will give you that reward they always tell you you're going to get, the reward of self-respect and the reward of satisfaction when you deliver your excellent best right now. And then I realized you got to have a good attitude for that. So it became my three-step program. Accept all things. It doesn't matter that you're not getting the good jobs anymore. Relax. Put it behind you. Accept it. It doesn't matter you're not getting the Winnebago anymore, Bob. It doesn't matter she doesn't love you anymore, Bob. Once you accept it, you are in position to deliver your excellent best. And when you deliver that excellent best, you know what they give you. They give you self-respect and satisfaction. And if you don't quit, you can win it in the late innings.
And he sure did. Robert Forster, we lost him just a few days ago. Great to have you with us for Film Week on KPCC.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.